Okay, we are live. Welcome to Uncommon. I'm Chance Lunsford. I'm the host. Please help me welcome today's special guest. I'm glad to bring on Dave Raboy today. First of all, welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Sure, my pleasure. Great.
Now, Dave is a man I had on the podcast before, and since the last time I talked to him, and I was kind of talking to him in the context of the nation and whether, interestingly enough, whether or not he thought we had gone too far to kind of survive as a nation, but I'll leave that aside for now. I brought him back on because he wrote a book called Qatar's Shadow about how the money coming out of Qatar is influencing policy and culture in the United States through things like think tanks and universities and the media and lobbyists, kind of the usual route for these kinds of things, and how that doesn't necessarily work out in our favor militarily or politically or culturally in the long term. And I thought that was really interesting. And so that's why I invited you back on, Dave. So, you know, why don't you fill in the gaps there of anything you feel like I left out, and then we can kind of jump into it.
Sure. I began the book and I began my interest in, let's say I began my interest in the subject of Qatar through, more than a decade that I spent sort of studying the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood's kind of largest state sponsor, in many ways, really, really tied at the hip, has been the Qatari royal family, which you know, runs that particular Gulf emirate. I call it the Islamist emirate. So with basically unlimited funds, you know, Qatar is sitting on the world's largest natural gas, deposits, and they use their money very shrewdly, which I thought was interesting. And as you said, they used it in order to affect political change, really in modern day Rome, which is the United States. By no means is it the only power that is doing so. I mean, it's the only Islamist power that is really doing so, with a kind of asterisk around Turkey, but it makes for a or it made for a kind of good case study in the nature of influence and the media and how this stuff works. You know, has worked for, you know, decades or a century, but has kind of worked qualitatively differently since the Iran deal and the Obama administration, since social media, since the death of the old media, you know, the death of the old media business model that happened in the 1990s. So it is a very new world. And I just kind of wanted to track it in the context of Qatar, which is small and manageable. Had I done one about China, for example, it would have had to have been, you know, nine times as long. And the links, let's say the Chinese problem with this, when it comes to influence through the political channels and let's say political infrastructure that is media and think tanks and government, is so strong it's all pervasive, right? that kind of really demands its own its own study and you know its own kind of very long book. It's not for me to write, though.
Okay. I just talked to a guy named Michael P. Sanger about a very targeted piece of the Chinese problem, as you put it, with regards to Xi Jinping's influence on the current state of affairs, we'll just say for briefness sake. But, I agree with that assessment that the China problem is so vast that the idea of spending, 18 months or a couple of years writing a book about it and putting out, you know, 100-page book or 200-page book, seems a bit naive if you really want to get into things. But what you did, and you said something very interesting. You said this was a case study. And to me, that sounds, and then you kind of wrapped it up by suggesting or leaning in the same direction, which is this was for you an exercise in putting your own skills of this analysis of this new mechanism of influence to the test in a way that you could demonstrate that there's a validity and sort of like an untapped power in analyzing things through this lens. And that's why I wanted to read the book, to be honest, because I've been thinking about these things through that lens for a long time. And, you know, I'm kind of a 30,000 foot guy just because that's my inclination. And I wonder, maybe to begin, what do you think the toolkit that you have or that other people might need if they wanted to analyze the world through a similar process? What's the toolkit that you need, or the skill set, or even just the, you know, the character traits that one might need to do a good job of it?
Right. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I wrote the book because, you know, one reason I wrote the book is I thought that the American people kind of need this particular skill set, which is to be able to see, sort of what's happening, with their own eyes. And I spent a lot of time in the book talking about Russiagate, actually, because Russiagate is something that a lot of people are aware of. And it's another perfect case study of what happens when, let's say all of these institutions that are sort of created to have an effect on our body politic are spun up and in motion in order to achieve a goal. For example, I've developed over the course of my career an ability pretty much, I mean, obviously it's not perfect because this is an art, not a science, but I can look at a news article and with, you know, a fair degree of certainty, have some idea of how that article was generated. Probably the most important insight, I think, that or the important takeaway for most people when it comes to the media today is to banish the idea that we used to have of, you know, that was actually once kind of true, of a beat reporter walking around, feet on the pavement, talking to people in the neighborhood, and just like someone tells him a story, or
in a fedora,
something in a fedora, right. And it's like, okay, I'm going to hunt this down because this is, you know, like there's corruption at the docks, and I'm going to get to the bottom of it. You know, that doesn't happen anymore. You know, whether or not it ever did really that way, that's another issue, but it's sure as shit doesn't happen anymore. Now you have people who, you know, full disclosure, like me in a past life, I would show up to a reporter and I would say, hey, I have this, you know, story. I've got the evidence. I've got a number of people for you to contact that, as witnesses or as, you know, evidence or whatever. I've got here people to comment, and basically you write it, but the story is here. And I wasn't the only one doing it. In fact, you know, a lot of DC does it. People do it for no money. People do it for money. Fusion GPS is a really good example, because Fusion GPS get paid by the media outlet to generate stories. So they're paying their journalists, but they're also very often paying Fusion GPS to come up with the material that they will feed to journalists. And then, of course, Fusion GPS is getting paid on the other end because they're working for clients. So these stories are not your typical human interest story. This is like, you know, they're working for an oligarch of some kind, or a foreign government of some kind, or a company of some kind. And like, hey, you know, here's a story that we want to push that makes our client look good. And they get money on both ends, which is a pretty damn good deal. I haven't been able to figure out exactly how to do that.
I haven't figured out how to get money on any end, right, of my media presence. That's right. How you can tell I'm not working for an oligarch.
This is really how it's done. And I would, you know, direct the listeners to a really important article in The New Yorker, of all places, about Elliott Management owner, Paul Singer, who basically conducts his business through media operations. And uses, let's say, a lot of the same strategies, if not the same actual human beings, that Fusion GPS is involved with to create stories and create narratives. And so, yeah, I mean, that's really the big takeaway for people. I think people should be cynical about how news is generated because that cynicism is well deserved. That's even before you get into the sort of constellation of think tanks and government and, you know, the same people going from think tank to government to the job to think tank to government job to think tank to government job. You know, somebody, some donor is paying for all of that. And in this case, you know, in the Russiagate case, again, you know, we happen to touch on Paul Singer again, because he is a guy who funds just about all of the anti-Russia, anti-Putin think tank world. Let's say on the right. So of course you're going to be, let's say you're a Russia expert. You come out of school and you're like, this is the area of the world that I want to study. I'm very interested in this. Oh, look, the only two people that are paying money to think tanks, you know, the places where I can get work doing, you know, the stuff in my field is George Soros on the left and it's Paul Singer on the right. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. So that means I've got to accommodate my views in order to their point of view in order to get money. And then once you get money, if you're lucky, you go and you get a job on, you know, House or Senate committee. Maybe you're a member of staff for a senator or a congressman, and you know, you keep doing what you're doing. But of course, you know what you're there to do, because when you eventually leave government, you're going to want that job back at Brookings or any number of places. So you've got an incentive structure where even if you really kind of like you've really, really got to want to do the right thing. And often it's very hard, you know, it's not like people are getting, it's not like everybody's kind of dissenting and grumbling and sort of taking bribes in order to push a particular point of view. I mean, a lot of these people, I'd say 99.9% of these people, they really believe, what they're saying. So they think, you know, life is great. You know, they get to say what they want to say. And there are, there are folks who are paying them. And then their profile is lifted when, you know, Fusion GPS, and MSNBC and whoever wants to talk to them and wants to use them as experts in their, in their articles. So it's a big ecosystem. You know, it's an information operations, ecosystem that is particularly vulnerable to information operations. Mm.
I have some questions about that. Allow me to weave a few elements together for a second.
Sure.
Element number one, I suppose, is that I found myself on the periphery of a recent event. I don't necessarily want to give voice to it. We can, I suppose, if it comes up. But for the context of this conversation, I've had a lot of people in the media contact me for my opinion on a story. Mm-hmm. And I basically told them to get fucked because I don't want to talk to them because I know what they're about. And I also know that the full story of this situation is not likely to be told ever, but especially by somebody out there with like a bone to pick. Okay. The next element in this is I like you, Dave, and I think you're smart and personable. But at the same time, also, obviously, and without assigning any sort of moral qualitative situation to it. You have a position. That position comes with some momentum. Some might call that an agenda, but we can just call it your worldview. Mm-hmm. And that worldview obviously influences the stories that you decide to pick up.
Sure.
The way that you present them and the people, like, for example, in that conversation we just had, I do think that you did a good job of pointing out that there are people on the right and on the left who are assholes and play this game in this dirty way. But obviously you have, your associations are, you know, much more on the right. My own are too, just because of my own worldview and my character. Those are the people that I find myself, getting along with the best and having less problems with. But to the people who might be listening or, you know, paying attention to this same question, but who have an ideological stance or like a worldview that is maybe not even in alignment, like maybe might be adversarial with yours and with sure. yours and mine. But what do you say to them in terms of learning how to maybe dissociate what they want for the world from what the people who know that present to them in a way that maybe like a person who I disagree with on fundamental principles, I can actually have a conversation with that person about their principles and mine instead of the stories that we've been fed by, you know, whoever on the right or left. And how do we, in a broader sense, what can be done on a personal level, because I realize you're not going to change, the world and the policy and everything, but on a personal level, how do you arm yourself against being overly manipulated or even like what, like you have 12 stories on Twitter trending, for example, or whatever. I shouldn't pay attention to any of them probably, but what am I supposed to, you know, what am I supposed to do about that?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's a really good question. It's, you know, maybe another way to put it is what happens when, you know, I'm not here to say by any means that, let's say corruption and information operations are exclusively played by folks on the left or, you know, or any of that. I mean, I don't want to say that it happens on the right, you know, as well. When it happens on the right, and it's especially egregious, I mean, I call it out because I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it's helpful. For example, I mean, I spent a lot of time telling people that QAnon was bullshit. And, you know, but in a kind of more granular way. So, you know, in addition to saying, well, you know, QAnon is bullshit, I'll say, no, okay, let's take these claims one by one. Or for example, you know, some of the folks like, you know, Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood and whatever, you know, popped up around the time, you know, late in 2020 around the election. And they were advancing a narrative about what is this thing, Hammer and Scorecard, which they claimed was a kind of CIA created, piece of software that changes votes. You know, I was out there saying, guys, what they are saying does not add up. And because I believe that at the end of the day, we're here, we can't get anywhere with conspiracy theories and lies. We just can't. Mm. It pushes you into a place where, it pushes you into a place where as a citizen, you're really useless because you are nothing but an observer of forces, powerful forces, powerful and dark forces beyond your control, you know? Okay. And at that point, when you start, you know, when you start believing in anything, I mean, you'll really believe anything. And you'll lose your mental faculties, you know, when you start believing things that are obviously not true. Then, you know, or let's say there, I'll say, because most of this stuff exists not in the realm exactly of very not true. It exists in the realm of really fucking unlikely with no proof. So it's like, and then of course you see this. I mean, I was really kind of devastated to see folks. I shouldn't have been surprised, but there were a lot of folks on the right who were, saying things like, "How, you know, prove it's not true." And at that point, I'm like, look, you've lost the ability to think. You've lost the ability to understand, you know, the world. This is definitely not how you go through life. You know, as a, you know, as, I mean, you can't go through life always thinking that, you know, the things, you know, I mean, it's just,
I have a question for you. Yeah. I have a question for you about that.
Sure.
Let's assume, that you're absolutely correct about QAnon, and let's just set that aside. Like if you wanted to create a QAnon phenomenon from the ground up, how would you do that? And who would you pick to help you?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't, maybe it's my professional or personal failing or something, but I don't think like that. You know, yeah, I mean,
noted.
I mean, probably my biggest, you know, my biggest professional failing is the fact that I'm just not, you know, I'm just kind of by nature, I'm not a deceiver. Hmm. And there are people who really kind of get off on that. And I will never be able to live with myself. If you know, I'm in the situation where I'm pushing a story that I know is not true, that I know is bullshit. And, you know, and because I think it's so harmful to people, I mean, look, I don't give a fuck what happened, you know, what we do, in a foreign country with, in regards to psyops and what we get people to believe. No, we're in a war with, you know, with another state, citizens of another state. Okay. Tell them anything, make them confused, break their will, do the whole thing. That's how we should do it. I would rather have, you know, psychological operations and political warfare, you know, than dropping bombs that kill people. But yeah, within the United States, I mean, these are my fellow citizens, you know, and even more than that, I'll say, based on what I believe is coming in the future, these are the people that we need, you know. This is really like to I don't think it gets any worse than taking advantage, than sort of knowingly taking advantage of your own people and making them stupid.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's scope in a little bit and use that backdrop now and that skill set sort of question to come back to the Qatar situation. Okay. And maybe we can get a little more granular with the Qatar situation. Mm-hmm. That will help people like concretize what we just talked about. So we're looking at Qatar. Al Jazeera is obviously a potent tool that they use, as well as the Petrobucks that you just talked about and their influence that it buys them in the various places. Let's say I'm Qatar and I've just come into money and realize I can play on the stage like this. How do I get my start and where do I go from there?
Okay. Let's say we've got fictitious country Q, right?
Okay. Sure. And, okay.
Yeah. Fictitious country Q, whatever it is.
That's hilarious.
They've just come into money. They've just come into a lot of money. They've discovered oil and they're like, wait a minute. So what does fictitious country Q do? The first thing they do is they say, we're a tiny little country surrounded by a lot of, you know, a lot of larger countries that we, you know, that we understand as predators. Some of these people are our cousins. You know, what are we going to do, number one, in order to protect ourselves, let's say physically? So the first thing they do is they align themselves with a great power, or they align themselves with, you know, with a power that can project, you know, force over, across the globe. In this case, you know, what the Qataris did was that first they aligned with the British, and then they made an alliance with the Americans, with us. And that
probably brokered by the British, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's been a while since I remember the details, but really, yeah. I mean, it coincided with the decline of the British Empire and you know, in this century and the rise of, you know, let's say the
colonies.
the new colonies. And they're like, okay, well, you know, if we can't depend on the English Navy, we better depend on the Americans. So they figured out a way way to do it. Now they were really kind of up Schitt's Creek for a while because our soldiers were based in Saudi Arabia, which was right next door. They are right across the Gulf from Iran. They were quite vulnerable, but then September 11th happened, and immediately, Bin Laden said one of the reasons why he did 9/11 was because the U.S. military was in Saudi Arabia. Okay, then the U.S. military decided to give up their bases and to move to Qatar because the Qataris said, "Hey, come here. Well, you can stay for free. You've got one of probably the biggest air base in the region." In Qatar, which obviously it still puts the United States military on the Arabian Peninsula, so it doesn't exactly solve the problem that the United States thought that it would solve, but at least it got itself out of Saudi Arabia and into Qatar. And then once you've got your military, once you've got the American military there, then you can run all sorts of, all sorts of influence operations that, with that, you can make Qatar the most hospitable place that you can imagine for members of the military. You can, because they're not, because it doesn't cost them anything, and because the Qataris have the money to lavish on U.S. Service members, and it's people love it. It's a great place, and it creates a strong feeling of support in the U.S. military, and also in the foreign policy universe for the state. So I mean, in that respect, we're keeping a base there, but they're actually benefiting from that relationship, and the ability to do that through that relationship. Okay, so once we've taken care of,
let me jump in real quick. I have a question about it. You said there's that point where you talked about where they're sort of supremely vulnerable, and then 9/11 happens and allows them to leverage that to get the base. Okay, 9/11 and Bin Laden himself. There's some questions of how that monster got created, right? Okay, we can just kind of say that and let people think what they want to think. But in that period of vulnerability, there's still some money floating around, and there's still some things being done. And I guess I wonder, it's awfully things major happen only when they're prepared to happen. Like an airbase doesn't just pop out of nowhere. Do you know what I mean? Deals have to be made, agreements have to be made. And so I guess I'm wondering, in that period where the vulnerability happened, how did that deal making happen to where they were able to survive and not just get railroaded by their cousins or by us or by anybody else?
Yeah. I think it had to do with the fact that the first Gulf War, kind of Kuwait was in the way, and you could possibly see another scenario. Let's say there was no Gulf War and no liberation of Kuwait. Let's say nobody lifted a finger. You may be able to say that, that Qatar could have been next on the menu for Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Obviously it's a counterfactual, so you'll never know. But the fact that the United States jumped in there in the first Gulf War, and was, let's say, prepared to defend the territory of some of these places. I mean, specifically, of course, it was prepared to defend Saudi Arabia, which probably would have been next on Saddam's list. And, you know, I mean, you know, Saddam in control of, you know, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia would have been a global kind of economic calamity. But I think that's what was going on, which was the fact that the United States and the coalition, you know, stood up strong against Hussein. There was not going to be any other type of warfare going on. I mean, probably Qatar was reasonably secure, kind of after seeing that. On the other hand is, you know, you've always had the little bickering back and forth between the cousins in Qatar and in Saudi Arabia, and then also to a lesser extent in the other Emirates and in the UAE. And this has always been a kind of rivalry, and the book kind of really starts when this rivalry breaks out into the open in the summer of 2017.
And why did it?
It's actually complicated. You know, there are surface reasons, and then there are kind of deeper reasons. Probably the biggest surface reason was, or let's say the biggest deeper reason was that there was a Republican in the White House, and the way Middle East politics goes, especially with this region in the world, and especially at this time, the Qataris, let's say the Qataris were Democrats, and the Saudis and Emiratis were Republicans. You know, what does exactly that mean? That gets to the more surface cause, which is the Arab Spring happened under Barack Obama. Barack Obama was a full-throated endorser of that. You know, what was the Arab Spring? I mean, people think it was, you know, an uprising against the monarchies for democracy and blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, it was that on TV, but what it was on the ground really was the Muslim Brotherhood trying to topple all of these monarchies. And after spending decades sort of patting these guys on the shoulder and sometimes funding them, but definitely looking the other way, both the Emiratis and the Saudis said, oh my God, what the hell did we do? We allowed the Brotherhood to take root. We thought, hey, as long as they're on the other side of the world, you know, we're fine. We don't care. And it created, you know, the problem metastasized and really threatened to take over the countries in the Middle East. And I mean, it happened with Egypt, Tunisia, almost happened with Libya, Syria. They were trying to get it to happen in Saudi Arabia. I mean, that was the crown jewel. And the Saudis and the Emiratis said, nope, not going to happen. And they got very involved in the anti-Muslim Brotherhood fight, to the point where in 2011, the UAE designated U.S.-based Muslim Brotherhood legacy groups as terror organizations. So like CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, they run all around Capitol Hill. They are all over the media. You know, they're a pressure group, but the Emiratis recognize that this is a pressure group that was founded by and still remains closely ideologically tied to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood. Why we can't recognize that? That's a whole other, you know, that's a whole other kettle of fish. And it speaks to the fact that around that time is when the Saudis and the Emiratis around 2017, they realized we have Donald Trump in the White House. We're, you know, he has made comments about supporting a ban on the Muslim Brotherhood. He is going to, he is going to sort of help us in this fight against the Muslim Brotherhood and its chief ideological sponsor, the state of Qatar. So the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Egyptians and, you know, a group of countries got together in the summer, and they said, look, Qatar, you need to do a couple things. Number one is you need to banish the Brotherhood from your country. Number two is you need to stop fomenting revolutions via Al Jazeera in our countries, which was a very important thing. You know, you need to stop playing footsie with the Iranians. And of course, I mean, it was not a thing that Qatar was willing to accept because their legitimacy, their state legitimacy is based on the royal family's relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood. So like they weren't about to accept that. So then what happened was there was a blockade, and it was a blockade of Qatar. You could not, you could not travel to Qatar from Saudi Arabia or the Emirates or other places. They had to, they had to bring food in, and because there's not much that Qatar produces other than oil, and there was a lot of pressure here in the United States and around the world to force Qatar to, to do these things, to get rid of the Brotherhood, to let's say pull back Al Jazeera from using it as like a political weapon, a media weapon against its enemies. So the Trump administration was at first very forthright in supporting the Saudis and the Emiratis and the GCC against Qatar. And then, they flashed some money around, and as was very common with different, issues, let's say the Trump administration was not able to follow through at all, zero. And after a while, really the State Department won, the Pentagon won, and they were like, hey, the Qataris are wonderful allies and blah, 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 all this nonsense. And it just set the stage for the Democratic administration of Joe Biden, which is unbelievably pro-Qatar. I mean, we just had the emir coming to visit the White House, and it was, high fives and smiles, because Qatar was for 4 years of the Bush administration, it was like the foreign capital of Never Trump and, of the resistance. There was a lot of money changing hands between Qatari, officials and, like, let's say Qatari state charities, and also Never Trump people and hashtag resist people. So now you have a situation where the Qataris are, very much in favor, based on the administration. Now a Republican administration comes in, I have faith that maybe they'll do the right thing and they'll sort of reverse this and go back to our kind of traditional allies in the region, or at least go with the allies that hate the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, it's not that hard.
Okay, I have a question, or like,
sure.
I have some stuff here. So everything you just said comes from like a particular vantage point, let's say. Mm-hmm. Okay, Dave, and you said before, like, whatever we're going to do in other nations, I don't care. I don't give a fuck what information operations we run. Okay. What would you say to a person who says, well, Dave is coming on Chance's show and doing the exact same shit he's just talked about Qatar doing, but from like from a different worldview, let's call it like an American worldview, or like a Jewish worldview, or any of the pieces of who you are. Okay. Cause I've had this motherfucker in the comments on YouTube, and he's coming after me because of my association with the event I was just talking about, with the author turned mass murderer, Lyndon McLeod, who was my friend. And that's been a shitty situation to deal with. And people like to talk about it, and they can eat a dick, but he's also been saying, that you're a propagandist for Israel, and you're coming on my show to take advantage of the fact that I'll let you read your talking points. And I don't feel like that's the case. But what do you say to somebody like that? Because people have assumptions when they come into a conversation or they come into being an audience in a place, and they usually don't know what they're talking about, and they like to rile people up. And I'm pretty sensitive to this subject because I lost a friend and he went out in a shitty way and it hurts a lot. And people talk about this situation. I'm sorry for getting emotional with you, bro, but I've heard a lot of people talk about this situation, and I haven't heard a lot of people who know what they're talking about talk about it. And I'm keeping silent because I had a relationship with a friend, and people want to know what that relationship was about with their teeth and claws out and try to take advantage of me. And if I thought you were trying to take advantage of me in a way that I couldn't just like see coming and neutralize, I wouldn't have you on my conversation. Wouldn't have you on my podcast. But what do you say to somebody like that who's coming for you and wants to hurt you as a way to further their ideological viewpoint?
Well, I'm sorry about your situation.
No, it's okay. Okay, bro. It's just, you know, but it's a reality for people. Like,
yeah,
I'm not a media personality. I'm Chance Lunsford. And right. People out there, who are not media personalities, this shit hurts them in a real way in their real lives. So what do you tell people to withstand?
It also hurts. I mean, I do a lot of media. I mean, things in my life I'm certainly not immune. I mean, we're not immune from truly horrible things, happening to us or to our friends. And, and it's terrible. And then when you see people who are trying to make hay of it or to use, a kind of, terrible thing that you were, tangentially related to or whatever, as a weapon against you. I mean, it's really disgusting. As far as your question goes, like, what do I say to people? I say, look, I mean, there are people of goodwill that I'm perfectly happy to engage with, about this and to talk about, my biases, which are absolutely upfront. On the other hand, you also have people who, are not here in good faith, and they just kind of want to poke the bear. I don't have time for those people. I don't, feel like I need to justify myself to those people. In regards to the question, I mean, yeah, I support I support Israel. I support a strong relationship between Israel and the United States. I support Saudi Arabia because they fight, the Muslim Brotherhood, and they fight Islamism. I think political Islam is a cancer, and it's a threat really to all of us. If you don't think so, then, I'm not exactly sure what to tell you. We can vehemently agree to disagree, on that point. That's my position. I comment things from a pro-America point of view, which is why I feel like, alliance with these countries is important. And especially since, I think the United States has done way too much in the world and would benefit from pulling back in many ways, especially when it comes to our military commitments. Absolutely. In order to do so and still maintain any semblance of influence and power, which is what makes our lifestyle possible, we need to then empower our allies. And we pull back to the extent that we empower our allies to, sort of do the right thing in our stead. So you can't just pull back and disappear and say, okay, guys, we're done, because the entire house of cards falls. The entire economic house of cards falls. And, like it or not, the United States has a responsibility to protect the free flow of cargo and oil and gas and things like that through, you know, through some pretty precarious places in the world. If it would not be for the United States, it would be, you know, let's say China doing that. Do we trust the Chinese? You know, do we trust the Chinese to do that? These aren't things that sort of just happen. Because we are a superpower, there are a number of things that we need to take care of that nobody else can take care of, or that we don't want anyone else taking care of, because whoever's going to do it is going to find themselves in a, you know, with a tremendous advantage. So in order to sort of smartly pull back our commitments, especially militarily, empowering our allies to do things in our stead that benefit both them and us, I think is key. So that's how it, that's how I'd answer that question.
Doesn't that require us to actually care about our allies' needs, like as a matter of course, their own needs versus because what I'm trying to get at is, if I want to be your friend, not necessarily a political ally, but if I want to be your friend, my first question is like, what do you need? And then my second question is, how can I help you get that? And I think when our foreign policy is based on the question of like, what are we trying to get? People can sniff that out from a mile away. And I don't know how we, correct that, because of course that's the whole point of the State Department, is how does the U.S. get what it wants overseas?
Yeah, that should be the point of the State Department. Right, right.
But, you know, like the question is, why don't, it's like, there's a lot of ways to lead with giving that come with hooks too, that come with like traps in them, and the IMF and the World Bank and the United States and China and everybody are sure good at doing that. But how do we empower our allies without making them feel like we're being shitty and sneaky?
Well, okay. So to carry forward your kind of friend metaphor, you know, you don't make friends with, you know, you don't make friends with a, you know, whatever, a homeless, drunk, drug addict who, you know, will need your help all the freaking time. And, you know, and put you, I mean, you could, right? But you don't put yourself in the position of counting on them, because you can't count on them. You find stand-up people, and you find people who, like, you know, I mean, nation states, you know, nation states and people, it's very hard, because there's all these, you know, even in the most simple, you know, in the most simple arrangement, like, let's say, you know, you have a monarchy, even within the monarchy, you have many different competing strands and intrigues and all this stuff. I mean, you don't have to have a sort of democracy for all of that. It happens in, you know, with really every country. But you try to find ones that are stable. You try to find ones that want to, you know, that want to prosper, that like you, that want to put money into your economy, that want to, you know, that want to create kind of longstanding partnerships. You know, for example, like the Abraham Accords, right? A lot of people believed that that the Israelis and the Arabs would sort of would be at each other's throats forever. Well, yes, that was true for a time, but then at a certain point, they realized, wait a minute, you know, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity here, to band together, not just against Iran, but also, you know, the Arabs have a lot of money, the Israelis have a lot of tech, you know, that stuff needs to get funded. There are all kinds of opportunities that can happen between countries that, you know, at the end of the day, we want our allies to succeed the same way we want our friends, you know, to our friends to succeed, and we want them also to have our backs, in the same way that that, you know, we have their backs. And now, of course, people will pop up and say, hey, you know, this country did this thing, and then this other country did that thing, and then we did this thing, and blah, blah, blah. Unfortunately, it's a big old mess, and you will never get, sort of 100% clarity on everything. There's a lot of noise. There's a whole lot of noise going on. And that's just the nature of foreign affairs. That's just the nature of dealing with big countries, with, you know, big consequential countries, even small ones.
Okay. I have a smaller question and then a larger question. Mm-hmm. And that's probably going to take us to the point where we can start to wind down, because we're getting close to an hour right now. And so I don't want to take, too much of your time. But my first question is, do you suppose that the influx of Muslim Brotherhood flavored Islamism into the political landscape of, let's call it, like North Africa and the Middle East, had something to do with the more robust relations between, let's say, Saudi Arabia and Israel, and sort of that coalition that came together to shake hands while Donald Trump was president? And then the broader question is, given the sort of fundamental worldview differences between, let's call it the Western worldview and the Islamist worldview, you know, what do you say to the people who suggest on one side or the other that the only answer is to eradicate the other worldview, and the leaders in the countries that are the representatives of them? Because do you suppose that political and economic pressure is going to be enough to undermine the ideological differences, or how do you suppose that's going to be reconciled? Because you said earlier you would prefer if we could play some psychological and political games to disarm people, but that doesn't disarm people forever, especially when we're talking about like a fundamental difference in the approach to the way they think life should be run. So how do you reconcile those things? What do you suppose is the answer? I mean, and I know that's complicated and kind of a dumb question,
Good question. It's a good question. Okay, so first of all, the rapprochement between Israel and the Arab states, including Saudi Arabia, didn't come along until well after. It was, you know, more a reaction to the ascendance of the Muslim Brotherhood than the cause of it. It's one before the other. Sure. You know, if you want to get sort of granular in terms of the, you know, specific kind of key moments in that move towards, what could be called peace or reconciliation or something, we can do that. But it was a thing that was kind of a long time coming, and probably certainly would never have happened without the advent of the Arab Spring, which was the Muslim Brotherhood exploding across the region with the help of the U.S. government in doing so. Hmm. That kind of very much accounts for Syria as well. So the other question was basically how do you do this? What, you know, does it necessarily mean, you know, if it's like, let's say, let's say it's America, or let's say the West, the values of the West versus Islamism. I think at the end of the day, all of these things are changing, right? So on one hand, the West is going through all of these things are changing on one hand, and on the other hand, they're sort of kind of meeting in the middle in a really interesting place. So on one hand, you have the terrible excesses of, let's say, the Islamic worldview in the form of Islamist movements, right? ISIS, Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, you know, these organizations that are basically death cults. You have that on one hand. On the other hand, on the West, you also have death cults of the West. You have the woke death cult of the West. And these folks are, you know, frankly, they're in, social and political ascendancy, you know, in many ways. They've taken over most of the, most of the key institutions, in many ways, similar to the Muslim Brotherhood, when it took over, you know, the same type of cultural institutions in the East over the course of the last several decades. So you've got sort of like you've got sort of a war going on both sides, internally and then externally. And I think what's happening is, let's say the conservative vision of the West and the like open vision of Islam in the East is sort of coming together, and people are seeing that it's actually pretty compatible. So for example, a good example would be, let's say, modern day Saudi Arabia, or the direction that the Saudis are going in now, or the Emirates, you know, which is, you know, Dubai and Abu Dhabi, which is a really good example of this, which is you have tradition, but you also have freedom. And these two things are always going to be in tension. You forget about one and, you know, the whole thing gets fucked up. And I think what's happening in the United States also is the same kind of process. And I think I've long thought that the nationalist movements in Israel, Hungary, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, the United States, Brexit, Brazil, all of these places have, like, you know, we can all get along really, really well because we all have an understanding of tradition and freedom and how that, you know, and how that tension works. And frankly, we're all against the death cults on both sides. And I mean, if there's one reason for why I'm sort of optimistic about the world, it's because of this potential coalition. You know, while you had Trump in office, you could have had it had you had a leader with, let's say, with the vision to sort of understand what was happening across the world. But like, I mean, I think the Muslim world is you know, moving towards freedom, just as the Western world should be moving towards maybe, you know, let's say more traditional, more conservative things. And I think there's a place to meet in the middle that could be very fruitful. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, obviously this is a minefield in terms of nationalist movements are so vulnerable to their own set of things. And they're, you know, charismatic leaders can be real dark dudes. And, you know, Hollywood and DC are not bright places. And those are sort of the places that are sending out the American message. And the rest of us aren't doing a good job of, you know, I tell people that Utah is the best place in the world and that it's my kingdom. And when the time comes, I'm going to be the warlord of Utah. but the point is, there are very much, you know, I believe in what you just said, that the nationalist tendencies, or like the movements and the people involved in them from the ground up, that comes from a place of wanting to restore that balance that you were talking about, where there's a respect for what came before us, but then there's also an acknowledgement of the new opportunities that have come about from living in the world we live in. You got to mesh those two, and you have to be very realistic about both of them. It's like we have this momentum of, you know, our genetics, and I don't mean that in a racial sense, for, you know, just to be clear, I just mean that like we're human beings and we've got this long lineage of evolutionary momentum. And then we have our culture and we have all these things. And to just pretend that we can cut all of that stuff away and start with this blank slate is very foolish. And the hubris of thinking that we can outsmart all of the history of life and start anew and like, you know, write a new equation seems to me a very foolish notion. But the point I guess I'm trying to get at here is just that I just want to make sure that the listeners and you and I are on, you know, to be clear, I agree with a lot of what you just said, but this process is so vulnerable right now, and there's so much momentum going on already in the media, in people's opinions. And we saw what happens when we have divides over masks or over vaccinations or over who's influencing the media from what country or any of this stuff. Man, people really got terrible with each other and continue to be terrible with each other. And that does not bode well for any of these reconciliations, whether intranationally or internationally. And so I guess I hate to kind of leave or like end on that, but what do you tell people to maybe just help them be on the prepared positive for?
I think that, and I'm not the first one to say this by any means, but as we get more fractured domestically, you know, as things get more polarized and we have really, really nothing in common. I mean, I'm of the opinion that we really have nothing in common, you know, on a deep level. And the subsequent, you know, the years that come will sort of reveal that, you know, even more than it is today. But as it gets worse here in this country, I think we're going to be seeing that we will have opportunities, let's say different segments of this country will have opportunities to reach out and to, you know, create more fruitful relationships with, you know, folks abroad who are kind of natural allies. I mean, the best example of this is, you know, the best example of this is Hungary. I mean, Israel is another great example of this, which is like, you know, for a long time, there was a bipartisan consensus on, you know, support for Israel, but basically it's just a Republican, you know, it's the 51st, red state, really at this point. And the same goes for Hungary. You know, Hungary could be the 52nd. A lot of folks have been going over there. I mean, you know, it's, you know, full disclosure, you know, we used to work for the Hungarian government, in helping to get their message out to Red America. And, you know, I'll be going there. There's the first CPAC there at the end of next month in late March in Budapest. And the seeds of this relationship are going to be bearing fruit. You know, as I think as the years go on and as things get kind of, let's say, worse in the United States with polarization, we'll be able to look abroad and we'll say, hey, this is a civilization alternative that appeals to me. You know, we can work with this. This is great. I would love to see that type of thing happen in Brazil, with the Saudis, with the Emiratis, you know, in other places. I mean, we kind of see it with Poland to a large degree already, at least for, you know, let's say populist or nationalist movements that are there that sort of take, you know, they're all unified by the idea that they sort of take their heritage seriously. They take, they don't necessarily take religion seriously as religion, but they take their cultural heritage very seriously. And they understand the conception of borders and they understand that there are things that they must preserve in order to, you know, and to maintain their uniqueness in terms of maintaining their civilization. So many of us here in this country look to that and they say, hey, man, I wish we had that. And so you'll see sort of more of this. You'll see more of this cross-pollination. And I think that's really to the good, because at the end of the day, our domestic opponents in this country, they've got the EU. They've got plenty of these countries. They've got France, you know, let's see what happens with Zamora, but like they've got basically, you know, the EU, they've got China, they've got, you know, they've got a lot of countries that they do business with and that they kind of, you know, and, or they support ideologically. So, you know, it's a kind of natural progression. And, And I would love to see more outreach, specifically, like, you know, between red states and red communities like Florida and Texas and Oklahoma and other places like that, reaching out and really deepening a relationship, cultural, economic, political, with some of these other countries. I think that would be to the good. And, you know, and as I said, if there's one thing that I'm kind of bullish on, it's that, because these places abroad, they're not going to disappear. You know, they're not going to disappear.
In fact, they're kind of burgeoning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess we'll even get to see more of what comes with these different models as time progresses, and maybe as mistakes are made, which they surely will be, we can hopefully learn from those before maybe we find ourselves in a similar situation.
Right.
Well, look, man, this has been a very interesting conversation, and we kind of went far afield, and I tried to bring it back, but I didn't do a very good job because I just had
no questions. This was great. You know, it's a lot of good questions, and I think it's a really important topic, and you know, glad we got a chance to chat.
Yeah, me too. Is there anything you want to plug besides the book? And I'll put a link to the book in the show notes and everything, but anything you want to leave the people with before we sign off?
Yeah, I appreciate it. Check out my Twitter and my Substack, Late Republic Nonsense, where I'm doing podcasts, I'm doing articles, kind of political and cultural and whatever else.
Very good. Well, go check Dave out. He's got a good Twitter too. Entertaining. And we didn't really mention it during the course of the podcast, but he's the most jacked dude in media, right or left. So be on the lookout for the physique post too.
Uh-oh. Yeah. Well, you know, certainly not a professional, you know, certainly not. But maybe from the think tank world, that could be true, but I'll take it.
Very good. Well, once again, thanks for coming on. And with that, I think we're out of here, brother.
Thank you.
Very good.